Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are State of Alaska Epidemiologist Dr. Paul Anderson and the State Epidemiologist Joe McLaughlin. We'll be discussing the state's Health Impact Assessment Program. Why don't you stick around and learn how these assessments are used to improve the health of Alaskans. You can reach us at 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And we have a recently changed email address. It's now line1@alaskapublic.org. Please give us a call or email us with your questions and comments. Joe and Paul, welcome to Line One.
Thank you, Thad.
I'm always starting with definitions. I guess that's my science in the background, so we know what we're really talking about. So let's ask her what an epidemiologist is and what's the function, particularly in the state of Alaska.
Sure. Why don't I go ahead and start with that? This is Joe. So I would actually kind of back up one step and talk about public health in general and say that public health is really the practice of preventing disease and prolonging life and promoting health in populations. And we can do this through organized efforts and making informed choices as a society. And so epidemiology really is the basic science of public health. And it is classically defined as the study of the distribution and determinants of diseases in populations, and using this information to provide an evidence-based rationale for implementing specific public health interventions. The practice of epidemiology really typically follows sort of an orderly sequence, and it involves first sort of counting cases or events through surveillance efforts, and then making population comparisons. So you compare one population to another, and you develop hypotheses as to why diseases may be more common in one population than another, and then you test these hypotheses, and then you make scientific inferences, and then those inferences help implement public health interventions, such as, you know, the provision of vaccines or implementation of screening programs or, you know, the removal of contaminated food from the food supply, for example.
And the State Department of Epidemiology's function revolves around providing that day-to-day for the state.
It does. The section of epidemiology is one of the many sections. There are several sections within the Alaska Division of Public Health. And our section really has six major programs. It's got the Infectious Disease and Outbreak Response Program. It's got an HIV-STD program, an immunization program, an injury surveillance program, an environmental public health program, and now we have a brand new program, which is the Health Impact Assessment Program.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. What is a health impact assessment?
Well, a health impact assessment is, this is Paul, it's very new to most people, and it's basically the shorthand for it would be a study that helps inform decision makers when they're considering a certain policy or a public health program, or in our case in Alaska, a large development project. And there's a common definition that's used from the World Health Organization that defines an HIA as a combination of procedures and methods and tools by which decision makers do this activity. And so it also looks at the distribution of these effects within communities, and it also considers those things alongside environmental issues.
Mm-hmm. So is there an ultimate purpose for the health impact assessment?
Yeah, basically, pragmatically to inform a public decision. But obviously, just we all are concerned about human health and to look at and to increasingly understand how our development plans, our policies, et cetera, affect people.
So the health impact assessment is not done to say this is a good project, this is not a bad project, this is too expensive. It's just to look at the potential health impacts for somebody else to make those decisions, use that to make the decision.
That's right. The health impact assessment program really does step back from the whole decision-making, opinion-making process ourselves, and we submit information, and we basically review a project description that is given to us, and we do our best to sort of analyze what different health effects may result from that and give that information to the folks who will ultimately make the decision.
Hey, we had a caller call in really quickly, and I'll take her in just a second. But let's do a little bit of a history of health impact assessments. I was not aware of these myself, and so I wanted to have our listeners understand really where all this idea has come from and what's the history.
Yeah, I'll take that one. Internationally, health impact assessment has been practiced for a couple of decades at least, and the World Health Organization is one of the first places one would go to sort of learn about this history. And these have been projects funded mainly by the World Bank and looking at large development projects in other contexts. And in the U.S., in the last probably 10 years or so, there have been, I think, what do we look at, 80 HIAs that have been completed, and there's 40, I guess, in process. And these are mainly have a focus on urban built environment. But there's been a few that have been done with regard to natural resources and some policy decisions as well. But in the U.S., the bottom line is it's a rapidly expanding field, and the focus of much of the work is on cities and built environment. Here in Alaska, in 2004 is kind of when things got rolling. There were a couple of HIAs done on the North Slope for the Red Dog Mine and the National Petroleum Reserve lease. And these were HIAs that generated a lot of interest from folks, but also a large measure of concern that HIA be done in a way that's, if it's going to be done, it be done in a way that's excellent. And people began to get together and think about how this could be done more broadly in Alaska. And so there was a summit conference that basically happened in 2008. There was a working group that was established at that conference, and these folks began meeting about 3 years ago and established the HIA toolkit. And this is a guidance document that they all put together in order to guide the practice of HIA in the state. And so this is the short sort of history.
Were the original assessments done on the North Slope done by the state? I mean, I'm envisioning that other people could do this potentially, and you, before the program, you mentioned in other countries it may be done outside of a state auspices, for example.
Right, and these early studies were done basically on a grant-funded basis.
Uh-huh. Yep. By the state.
They were not conducted by the state of Alaska.
Oh, okay.
They were done on a grant-funded basis, I think, through the Pew Charitable Trust and uh-huh. the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Do you know where the impetus to that came? Did it come from the North Slope Bureau, or who asked to initiate those?
There was a very important figure in the history of HI in Alaska, Dr. Aaron Wernham. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Wernham began to become interested in these issues from working in the area. And his interest and his energy really fueled a lot of these early efforts.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and take our caller. Christiana, thanks for holding on. What can we do for you?
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me. I know that you said that the state is funding this HIA for the proposed coal mining project at Wishbone Hill, or was I mishearing that?
I don't think we mentioned Wishbone Hill. Did I mention that? No. Why did you ask?
I was just curious. Do you know who is doing the HIA for the proposed coal mining project at Wishbone Hill?
Yes. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I was just going to say I think that's an important thing to bring up, but I wonder, Thad, just thinking about the flow of this, and I wonder if it would be helpful to first go into sort of what is an HIA and the okay. science of HIA, and okay. then get into some of the specific HIAs that have been done in Alaska recently, and then some of the HIAs that are planning to do in the near future.
All right, Christiana, is that okay with you? We are
yeah.
going to address who is funding it. That's one of our questions, but we're going to work through what's on the agenda, and you're welcome to call back if that's okay.
Okay, yeah, no problem.
All right, thanks very much for your call. Okay. So tell us a little bit more about what are the agencies and groups involved in this project, particularly in Alaska?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, there was a sort of summit meeting that happened in 2008, and that consisted of groups from the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, regional health corporations like the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation. The North Slope Borough was a borough government that was involved. The state of Alaska, obviously folks from the CDC came as well. But in the state, you have people from all different parts of the state government and regional health corporations, local government, participating in HIA work.
And the toolkit was something that was developed at this conference, and it's designed to give a structure to what the state is doing or for others who might also be interested?
Yeah, it's basically a set of best practices. And so what it does is it's one of the earliest state guidance documents for HIA in the U.S., and it's about an 85-page document. It's quite technical, but it takes the reader through the main steps of an HIA, how to conduct one, what are the important resources, where do you find data, how do you handle sensitive personal health information. And it also addresses certain topics that are very unique to Alaska, subsistence, hunting and fishing, several issues related to sensitive ecosystems and climate change, et cetera. And so it's a very much a document that's unique to our setting here in Alaska.
It would seem to me that some of the health assessments the science may not be there, or the impacts may take a long time to determine. How are those issues addressed?
These are some of the challenging parts of coming to an opinion about a certain health topic when evidence is scant. And what you do, what anyone would do, is you'd find the best information you could. And if the information is somewhat scant, then you would make a cautious remark about that information. And one of the biggest challenges in HIA is tying some of these projects to, or policy to, a certain health outcome. And the data and the evidence and the literature is developing in this area, but it is one of the challenges for this work.
Mm-hmm. And is this involved in any way with the permitting and the natural resources within the state? Is it a factor?
Yeah, this admittedly was one of the first things I had to address as I started to learn about HIA when I started working in the program, and understanding how this all works took some time. But the largest projects in the state typically invoke the National Environmental Protection Act, mm-hmm. Or all shorthand known as NEPA. And a lot of people who are familiar with development will be very familiar with NEPA. But under this particular act, federal agencies are required to prepare what is called an environmental impact statement if the proposed action that they're considering has the potential to significantly influence the human environment. And so they conduct an EIS, and these have been, done since the act was put into place. And so within that process, most of the big development projects in the state fall within that process. And typically, the HIAs that we're working on now happen within that context. And so that's kind of where it fits in the permitting process in the state.
That seems to address the project aspect, but as I understand health impact assessments, it also may deal with policies and that are being implemented. And that seems to be a little bit different than maybe talking about economic or the environmental impact thing. Are you working on that, or how is that different in how it may come down and be evaluated?
I guess two things I can say. Number one is we're not currently working on any policy health impact assessments, but we would like to in the future. We're really...
For example, a policy might be that we ought to have more lights in traffic areas that might impact less car accidents or moose getting hit or something like that.
Exactly. Or policy regarding developing certain transportation corridors in in the city. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And so basically, we're not working on any of those particular policy HIAs right now. However, The interesting thing about NEPA is it's fairly regimented. Mm-hmm. And what I would imagine is that during the process of developing the HIA for a policy, it would not necessarily have some of the steps and some of the regimented process of the NEPA context, although it would be a part of a policymaking decision at some point. And as I said, that's really the point of an HIA, is to inform the decision makers.
So what is this document that you come up with? What does it look like, and where does it go?
Yeah, that's a great question. We typically, so far, I guess is the best thing I can say, so far we've produced one HIA, which is currently under agency review. So I wish I could show it to folks, but I can't. But it's typically a two-part document. The first part for a development project, for example, looks at the baseline health conditions in the region where the project is planned. And that's kind of the first half, going through a series of health effect categories, looking at different health indicators that we can collect. The second half looks more at assessing the actual risks that we identify by doing the baseline analysis and looking at the project. And so it's kind of a two-part document. They end up being about 80 to 100 pages long. And that's basically what the document looks like. And one more thing, it just basically, when they write these environmental impact statements, many of them are hundreds to thousands, maybe 1,000 pages long. And what we do is we take our health impact assessment and we tack it on to the end in so it's all together. And it basically goes on as an appendix so people can read it start to finish.
Why don't you take us through, if you don't mind, just a process of looking at a health impact assessment, from the very get-go to the document that's finished?
Yeah, it's been very interesting for us. As we're just starting, our program's very new, and so we've intersected some projects in the middle of their process, but we've gotten involved anyway, and that's been very exciting. But ideally, if you were to start an HIA from the very beginning with a clean slate, the first step people typically identify is screening, and that is basically group of individuals from various stakeholder groups and et cetera get together and decide, does this particular project need an HIA? Is it significant enough to really merit that? And if the decision is made to go forward with the project, then it enters into a period that people call scoping. A scoping process is basically, again, this is done in a group setting, but it's an identification of key projected health impacts. And people get together and discuss the project or the policy and think together about how it might impact health. In the development setting for us, we also, during the stage, we look at what are the potentially affected communities, which communities are within the health footprint of this particular project. But probably the most important thing to highlight under the scoping stage is that we actually go out into the community and we sit down with people, either by means of an interview or a small forum or a focus group, and we just sit and we listen and we solicit health concerns. What are they concerned about? And these need not be scientifically accurate concerns. These are just concerns that folks have. And we write them down, we document them, and we make sure that they're included in our assessment.
The one thing I'll add to that is, in addition to health concerns, oftentimes you'll hear, the benefits that the community feels they will incur as a result of a particular project going forward. So we not only look at the potential drawbacks or health risks associated with the project, but the health benefits as well.
Yeah, that's right. And many times people are right in front of you weighing these things together. Mm-hmm. So then after the scoping process, it moves into a step that we call impact rating. And we look at these community concerns, we look at the impacts that we've identified, and we basically try to ascribe to them, as best we can, some sort of a rank or some sort of a stratification, so we can get some idea of what are the most important health concerns that have been voiced and that are evident from the discussions we've had during the scoping process. And we have right now a risk ranking matrix that we use. It's available in our toolkit if people would like to see that. And it's an effort to be transparent and to take a health concern to show people how we're considering it. How long it's going to last? How well people will be able to cope with this particular health issue? And I know this is all very high level in general, but it attempts to ascribe a rank to a particular health concern or health benefit. And so that's the impact rating stage. And then after that, we basically propose, make recommendations. And this is a step in which we look at the group of health impacts that we've seen, both positive and negative, and we make recommendations in the document as to how people in the decision-making process, if they take these into consideration, might address them each. Mm-hmm. And that's in a table, typically, at the end of the document. And most people that will read a health impact assessment will turn right to that table and look for the impacts and the mitigations. And then basically, one of the things that's very important is that once we complete this work, we go back and we speak to the folks that have given us their concerns. We share with them what the impact assessment has concluded. And then finally, one of the things that is really important in health impact assessment, the last step is to monitor whether or not the health impact assessment actually had an effect on the decision, and also how the recommendations that were made are being carried out over time.
I mean, it's very much like any problem-solving kind of algorithm. I mean, you look at the problem, identify the problem, think up some answers,
sure,
and then go ahead and monitor.
Sure.
And
so very structured, yes.
Yeah. All right. Why don't we go ahead and take a short break at this time, and then I think what I'd like to do is come back and summarize what you've said so far into maybe an example or two, and I think it'll help our listeners. And I've got one person who's hanging on. I'll ask him to hang on, and we'll take his call as soon as we get back as well. Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue to talk with State of Alaska epidemiologist Paul Anderson and Joe McLaughlin. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. And today we're talking with State of Alaska epidemiologist Paul Anderson and the state epidemiologist Joe McLaughlin. We're discussing health impact assessments, particularly what the state of Alaska is doing in this regard and its efforts to try to help improve population health, I guess it's fair to say. So if you've got questions or comments, you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our direct phone number is 550-8433, and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, as usual, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday night, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, so we won't be able to answer your questions or take your emails at that time. Up to this point, we've really kind of reviewed the history of health impact assessments, the purpose, the benefits that may be accrued from that. And I think what I'd like to do now to maybe help crystallize what a health impact assessment's all about is go through one or two examples of what's been done. You've mentioned a couple on the North Slope that were done through a granting service, but what are you all involved in right now? Give us some concrete examples of one you've worked on, for example.
Probably the best one to discuss is and we're always careful to talk about these as proposed projects, but the proposed Dahlman Creek gold mine, which is 13 miles north of the village of Crooked Creek. It's about 280 miles northwest of Anchorage, and it's basically an open pit mine that's planned for ore extraction. At its largest, the pit would be a couple miles long and a mile wide, and it's basically truck and shovel work, and the projected processing of ore would be 50,000 to 60,000 metric tons of ore a day. It's about a 25 to 30 year project that they're planning, and the projection last time, and I'm just reading company information here, the projection would be that it would produce about 1.5 million ounces of gold a year. So this is a very big project out in the Yukon Kuskokwim, and so basically we have been involved with the Dahlman Creek mine since the program got started. And the first thing that we began to do was the project had already been screened. It was decided that an HIA was desired for this project. And so we entered into scoping discussions with folks. This project is in the pre-permitting stage. So it hasn't even gone to the stage of being permitted, but it basically is being evaluated on a number of fronts. And so we entered into those discussions with folks. I've taken a trip out to the Yukon Kuskokwim and met with several folks in these communities and done some listening exercises. And even before I arrived, maybe Joe, I'll let you talk about the river trip that you took there.
Yeah. So last year, a team of us went down and actually went to several of the villages and sort of had a very open forum discussion with folks asking what they really think the positive and negative health impacts of the proposed mine would be to the community and to the health of their community members. And so we used that information to help inform some of our preliminary decision-making process. But it was very helpful, and I think that in every community we went to, people were very thankful that we were there and asking them for their opinions.
What were some of the opinions? What were examples of what concerns were, and what were the positive aspects they might see?
Well, certainly some of the concerns would be impact to the river, the health of the river, and subsistence resources. There were some concerns related about culture, loss of culture, things like that. In terms of the benefits, certainly most of the benefits really revolved around increasing local economy. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we definitely heard the gamut.
Mm-hmm. Are those reasonable things to consider in a health impact?
Certainly.
I mean, you may not think about economics, but before we came on the air, we were talking about how one of the major factors in health of a population has a lot to do with the economic situation of that environment.
Yeah, and as we look at the sort of structured way we work through a project, we do consider 8 health effect categories, and one of them is the social determinants of health. Mm-hmm. So there are things that undergird the health context of a community, and one of them is the economic vitality of the region, jobs, etc. And so it's very much something that when people are concerned about that, they're right on target, and they intuitively understand how it's related to their health.
Do we need to say more about this Dahlman Creek project?
Just to say that we basically, after conducting these early visits and listening to folks, we're now in the process of going out to this will give people an idea of how this process works. We go to various state databases that exist online. Anyone can access them, the Bureau of Vital Statistics, et cetera, and we gather mortality and morbidity information based on the different areas that we've identified that are key for human health. We get demographic information. We try to get economic information if we can get our hands on that. And we basically are in the process of gathering that information now. In some cases, we have the advantage of the fact that I sit in the section of epidemiology. I can walk down the hall and I can ask someone to generate a report for me that's specific to this particular question, whether it's on accidents and injuries or sexually transmitted infections, et cetera. So we're gathering data together and we're working on a baseline health report for that area.
And the point of the report that I've heard is not to say whether it's this should make or break the deal. It's just for somebody to understand what the positive health aspects of this project are and the negative ones as we can see it with our best scope at this particular time.
That's right. And even in the earliest stages when we produce our baseline health report, it informs an applicant what is the context into which we're going to place this development for human health. What's the health context of this area?
And Christiana had called earlier and wanted to know about funding. So let's address this. Where does the funding for this type of work coming from?
In general, it's fairly commonly known that in the state there is a process by which when an applicant comes to Alaska and they want to develop, they can develop a contract with the Office of Project Management and Permitting, OPMP, at the DNR. And through this process, the DNR coordinates the permitting process for these applicants, whether it's ExxonMobil or Shell or one of these larger groups. And basically, through that contract, the DNR has a lot of folks in the state doing work for them to help with this process. And that's basically how funds flow to us for the program.
Okay. Tom, you've been holding on for a while. I appreciate that. What can we do for you?
Well, thanks for taking my call. I work with the North Slope Borough, have for 24 years or so, and maybe come at this from a different perspective. We first got involved, as your guest said, through working with Dr. Aaron Wernham in the context of oil and gas lease sales, both offshore in the Arctic waters and onshore in the NPRA. And with Aaron, we were able to convince the responsible agencies, the former MMS and the BLM, that they were required to do HIA. They didn't need to call it that, but they needed to do some kind of human health impact assessment under the governing laws of NEPA and the OCS Lands Act and the NPRA Leasing Act. And that our people were greatly frustrated for 30 years that you pick up one of these large leasing EISs and find hundreds of pages dealing with the potential impacts to bowhead whales, for instance, and appropriate mitigation to deal with those potential impacts, and you'd find scant, if any, dialogue about the potential health impacts on the people themselves. So that's where this all began.
Sure.
My question is, as one of your guests said, this all kind of broke about 7 or 8 years ago. At that time, without those legal mandates at the state level, we asked the state to do something comparable to an HIA for oil and gas leasing on the North Slope in the three area-wide lease sale areas where oil and gas is leased, Beaufort Sea, North Slope Foothills. And those processes are triggered by best interest findings that are conducted only once every 10 years. And just a few years ago, we began the process of revising each of these three area-wide lease sale area BIFs, best interest findings. And in each of those, there was a placeholder inserted saying, we understand the issue is out there. We will take it on and consider health effects when the state has finalized its HIA policy. So my question to your guests is, number one, have you finished it to a point where you're going to go back and through the supplemental information process, go back and revise those best interest findings to address health impacts? And then as a follow-up, I think we all understand, I hope we all understand, that the analysis itself, the assessment itself, doesn't matter if you don't react to it, if you don't do anything to mitigate or avoid any potential human health impacts that you identify through the assessment. And I heard one of the guests say, one of the steps is to go back and see whether decision makers acted on your recommendations. And so that's a great concern to us, that if, particularly in this climate, in this administration, if you identify impacts that may require mitigation or that change a project or make it more expensive, how confident are you that you will actually impose mitigation on oil and gas developers on the slope through the lease sale process and conditions attached to it?
Okay. Tom, why don't you hang on for just a second while one of our guests answer that, because I might want to come back with another question to you, too.
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
So I guess, Tom, I just want to, first of all, say, thank you for your involvement with human health and your concern for it over a very extended period of time. You've obviously been a great advocate and very interested in human health as it relates to your area. And we are very pleased to be working continually right now with the North Slope Borough has an HIA program, and we're working together with them. And I think that's probably a result of your efforts and many folks in the area who have been very forward thinking. And as you mentioned, Dr. Wernham is very much a part of that history. And I think in that context, I can let you know that, you know, we're very new as a program. And so one of the things we've been at pains to do over this initial year is to gather together all of the sentiments and the discussions and the issues that have been at hand, and to try to consolidate them into a structured program that can begin to function. And that involves a certain amount of programmatic activity, management, and setting up protocols, et cetera, establishing the toolkit. That's been a major accomplishment. And so one of the things that I guess I would say is, in response to whether or not the state's HIA policy has been finalized, if you look at the toolkit, it says version 1.0. And we're just really delighted that we've started in a formal way to address human health impacts. And we're really happy to see this program here. And I think a lot of your concerns are going to be increasingly addressed as we move forward.
And I'll just add to that. I really echo Dr. Anderson's comments, and really want to say thank you so much for being a leader on the North Slope in this area. As you know, health impact assessment is not required by law in the state of Alaska, but it is seen increasingly as a best practices approach to responsible development in our state. And so that's something we sort of hang our hats on. And the meat of your question is, what are the teeth of the health impact assessment? And really, at this point, because the HIA is not required by law, the recommendations are put out. And, you know, it's ultimately up to the project proponent whether or not they will follow the recommendations at this point.
Tom, let me ask you if you got a sufficient enough answer there. If not, cut me off and say, let's make sure we get your question answered. But I look at this as change, and change is never easy, almost never easy, I guess I should say. And there certainly must have been some pro and con arguments going on when this whole idea of looking at health impact assessments was being considered on the North Slope. And I'd like you, perhaps, for our listeners to hear what somebody on your end of this went through, what were the arguments, and then what's the outcome? What's the bottom line? Have the benefits been greater than the risks from your standpoint at the end here?
Yeah, thanks again. I appreciate it. I'll tell you, I maybe didn't get the answer I wanted, but I got the answer I expected.
Okay.
No disrespect to your guests at all.
Right. So you'd like to see this more formalized, more...
Sure. Again, we look at it, without trying to sound overblown, we look at it as a moral issue, that, you know, even if you don't have some legal hook to hang your hat on...
Right.
We ought to be looking at the potential impacts on human health. It doesn't get much more basic than that to the people who are most affected by North Slope oil and gas development. So we'd like to see it move forward as quickly as it can. We were able to get the federal agencies, once we sat down with them and made our case, they moved very quickly. Not always, as thoroughly as we wanted them to, but we're moving the ball forward as we move through each new planning process. But it's something as essential as saying to the people in our villages, these are the potential effects you may suffer, you may experience, both positive and negative, with respect to a coming project or with respect to leasing in your backyard or your waters. And we think it deserves the respect more so than the analysis that is done routinely with respect to the animals that might be affected. So we'd like to see it move forward quicker than slower. We all understand that the economics these days draw the politics to these issues, and anything that is perceived as a potential impediment to development or exploration or leasing tends to be shunted aside. We just saw the loss of our coastal management program, much to the shock of a lot of us out in the coastal areas.
Yeah, I mean, let me stop you just a second, but when we start thinking about the economic advantages, we may be doing the traditional American short-sightedness, and we may be looking at the immediate upfront costs and not paying attention to the downstream costs to healthcare that may be considerably more, and once again, passing things on. I mean, we don't know that, but that was my original, my thought about that comment of yours.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So up to this point, you're happy with what's happened in those assessments?
Considering how quickly they were done, how responsive the agencies were given their initial reluctance. I mean, typically I've sat in on first meetings with Dr. Wernham, with the former MMS, with BLM, with folks at DNR at the state level, and you get the exact same reaction. It's very interesting. I mean, in most cases we had four or five folks on the other side of the table, and you get the one guy who says we don't have the expertise, another one who says we don't have the money, another one says we don't have the time, another one says we can't make the nexus between this project and human health. That just seems vague to us. Mm-hmm. And you work at it, and with Dr. Wernham's expertise, mm-hmm. we were able to make our case. Then each of the agencies brought their lawyers in, and the lawyers at the federal level said, my gosh, yes, actually there is a legal requirement that we do this. Mm-hmm. Again, whether they call it HIA or not, mm-hmm. And we better get going, and we better do it. Mm-hmm. And our continuing push has been, once you identify potential impacts, given what admittedly is at times that fuzzy nexus, what are you going to do about it? Where's the mitigation? What are you going to require operators to do to address those potential impacts?
Right. Okay, I get it. Thanks, Tom.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Christiana again had mentioned or asked before about the flow of funding or the funding, and you had mentioned, Joe, that DNR, Division of Natural Resources, the Department of Natural Resources, I guess it flows the, so the money that comes in, is that true of all the projects that you're doing right now? Is that what typically happens? I just want to make sure I'm answering her question.
Yeah, as we sit right now, the projects we're working on are mostly NEPA projects, which are part of this big permitting process.
Okay.
As I understand it, the Wishbone Hill project has had a permit in hand for quite some time, and the funds from that for that particular project flow differently. And there are funds made available by the DNR to look at not only the Wishbone Hill project by itself, but coal development in Alaska mm-hmm. in general. So we're also working on the Chewitna mm-hmm. Proposed Chewitna coal mine as well. So there's a strong interest in looking at human health impacts for coal in the state, and this is the general flow. So it can be either through the NEPA process, or sometimes there. And again, this is our first year here. There is this situation in which the DNR has elected to fund a study to be done for Wishbone Hill.
So are these health assessments primarily done for the worker or individual living in a community, or the community itself, or even maybe statewide at times? I mean, are all of the above?
Well, it raises a couple of really interesting points. One of them is that actually the health impact assessments, we call it, they're outside the fence. So inside the fence would be occupational health. And most companies that are functioning in the United States have to have very robust worker safety programs. And so the health impact assessment actually leaves that aside. What we're mostly considering is outside the fence issues. Now, there's one exception to that, and that is that there's sort of an interface that can happen on roads when workers are off duty, et cetera, that we do think very seriously about. Most of the big multinational corporations that work internationally have the practice, for example, of closed construction camps so that workers are not interacting with local communities while they're on duty, et cetera. So that's the first important thing. And then we take the perspective that as we look at human health impacts for the communities, we draw out a footprint of how you move basically people and materials. And this begins to create sort of a footprint for the project that may go beyond the physical facilities of the project. This can also involve natural exposure routes like rivers, et cetera. So as you can imagine, the footprint for some of these, from the perspective of human health, these projects can be quite large.
Tom, in his call, kind of alluded to this next question that I have is how can we be sure that all the relevant impacts are identified? He also mentioned, and then you may get differences of opinion about the health impact. But let's stick with that. How you're being sure, or how well are we knowledgeable about the fact that all of the impacts are being identified in one of these assessments?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier we have a series of health effect categories. There's mm-hmm. 8 of them listed in the toolkit, and it's not written in stone, but they are a very useful list of health effect categories, and they are the social determinants of health, accidents and injuries, exposure to hazardous substances, food, nutrition, and subsistence. These are all different categories that I'm listing out here. Infectious diseases, chronic diseases, water and sanitation, and healthcare delivery. And what we do is we basically take the project description that we're given, and we set it aside one of these categories, and we just stop and we just think about, how is this particular project design going to interact and affect accidents and injury rates in this region? And we look at mortality, we look at morbidity, we look at whether or not this has been a problem that's been identified in the baseline report. And we do that for each one of these particular categories. And the next step that we do is try to boil that down to the ones that are most likely, you know, most compelling. And we actually list out discrete health effects that ask the question, is there going to be a change in this particular health indicator? Will there be a change in the rates of unintentional injury or the number of motor vehicle incidents, et cetera? We get very specific with these impacts.
What about Tom's point? Incidentally, that those lists are similar to what you would see if you went to and looked up what are the impacts on a population's health, what determines a population's health. And sure. It doesn't matter whether it's a country, a state, or sure. or whatever. Those are the kind of factors. I've seen them in a list of 6, and you got 8, but something like that. So that serves as your basis with which to begin to think about where the health impacts may be. What about Tom's? I think what I was hearing Tom say is you get everybody at the table and there may be disagreements about these things. I mean, so how do you what do you have to say about that? How common is that, those kind of disagreements? And does it get down to really what the science is at this particular moment, or how we interpret the science?
Well, yes, always interpretation involved. But I think it's important to sort of affirm that reality of public health. Is it always is happening with a shared context? And that's really how HIA is designed, with stakeholders and people having transparent access to information, et cetera. And so, yes, there will be folks that need more information. There will be folks that are not quite sure how a particular impact has been sort of arrived, how we've come at a ranking. And so what we try to do is be as transparent as possible. But it's inevitable that as we go through this process, that there will be some discussion, there will be some debate. And I think the one thing I wanted to he very helpfully pointed out is that when they presented this information to the folks at the table, it was new to many of them. And many of them were not quite sure. How was this going to happen? Sure. And I think we're still in that context. I'll speak with individuals in the state today that still don't know about and not as though they should, but they right. still are unfamiliar with HI. So we've got a lot of education that we can do, and a lot of informing folks about how this works. How is this going to affect you as an applicant? How is this going to affect you as a community? And so I end up in that situation a lot with folks who, for them, this is the first time they've heard of HIA.
And before I forget about it, you mentioned, I think, before the toolkit is available online. People can go and look at this process.
Yeah, people can go to www.epi.alaska.gov. That's EPIs. And basically, the toolkit is there. You can download it in PDF form, either the chapters individually or the whole document.
I think Kristen, who does our website and is engineering today, I think we'll make sure we get that up. We also have CDC links, some Pew Charitable Trust, and UCLA links as well to this idea of health impact assessment. So we'll add that link.
And I'll just say, if you go to that www.epi.alaska.gov site and then you do /HIA, that'll take you directly to the program.
Okay. Shauna, you're on line 1. What can we do for you?
Hi, I'm a Chicolin Village tribal citizen, and we've been working a lot on concerns about the proposed Wishbone Hill mine that's coming into our traditional area. And from just a tribal perspective, I mean, sort of taking out, you know, property value concerns that local residents might have from a tribal perspective, I'd just like to ask, you know, how the health impact assessment can, you know, how would this even really be utilized as a tool to protect our health? From a tribal standpoint, I mean, we know that the original mining that went into that area came in, you know, 1914 and around that time frame, and that it operated until about 1922 when the mine pulled out. And, you know, originally we had about 800 people in our village there. And after 1922, there were less than 40 indigenous people remaining. And, you know, of course, our oral history tells us about all of the problems that the mining originally brought in. And a lot of us tribal citizens feel like we're still suffering greatly from all the effects and impacts that were brought into our area originally by mining. And, you know, while I was doing some research online, I actually found some documentation that talked about how corporations today, for example, the African Barrick Gold Corporation that is looking to do some gold mining in Tanzania, is really looking at a health impact assessment as a way that they can promote being able to do development and really break into communities and gain what they're calling social acceptance, so that they learn how to get in, engage local health and social services, and then establish stakeholder groups, and then figure out how to establish a long-term social license to operate. My question is, sounds like this will be a great tool for corporations to get in and justify their work. How will communities like myself, who's just trying to protect our culture, our future generation, our kids, you know, right across the street from our tribal school, we can see the road going into the mine as we speak. They're clearing out a huge parking lot, and we know they're getting ready to go into our area and mine. And they originally polluted our stream. We actually had to get grants to restore the stream, and we're still trying to reintroduce the salmon stock into that area. You know, we're just barely recovering, and here the mine is looking at coming in again. How could this really be used as a community tool to protect human health versus just a corporate tool to, you know, ensure bringing development into an area?
Okay, well, let's ask our guests.
So, I mean, I think, Sean, it's important to just reiterate sort of how the HIA works. And, you know, basically we're in the process right now of going through the steps of the HIA. We're right now sort of in the information gathering phase. I've got several meetings scheduled with Chicolun Tribal Council, with folks in the valley that I'm working on getting set up. So I'm going to come out and listen to those concerns, and that's part of our process. And we're going to move right through listening to your concerns, gathering surveillance information for the area. And we're just going to follow the steps of what we do. We're going to look at all of the health effect categories that I just mentioned, the social determinants of health, accidents and injuries, hazardous substances, which includes coal dust and particulate matter. We're going to look at impacts to subsistence, infectious diseases. And that's basically, as an HIA program, what we do. And that's what we've been asked to do on this particular project. And we're just getting rolling in that process. And I guess I would say, you know, I'm looking forward to listening a lot over the next 2 to 3 weeks, hearing your concerns and those of your community, and including them in this study. And just to make one further point, we understand that the concerns that you have and the angst that I seem to hear in your comments is important, and that is that's also a part of our review process as well.
I guess to try to have my question answered a little better, does your health impact assessment take into consideration cumulative impacts in terms of other problems that our community might be exposed to environmentally, as well as sort of the idea of generational trauma? I've heard the social impacts that you're talking about, but I really wonder, does that also mean cultural impacts as well? Because from my experience, social can be differentiated away from cultural, and it's obviously, you know, we're a tribe, and I know the state of Alaska doesn't currently recognize any of the 229 tribes in the state, but, you know, just really wondering, will you take into consideration cumulative impacts, generational trauma, as well as just understanding, you know, what the issues are socially versus culturally?
Yes, we absolutely do. And if you go online and look at our toolkit, I'd be interested to get your feedback on our section of stakeholder engagement, and just to see, you know, what you think about that. But we do have an entire chapter in the toolkit that addresses the importance of culture and cultural change to the health of Alaskans. It's very important to us. It's an essential part of what we do, and it's basically a whole chapter in our toolkit.
So when they do the blasting and it breaks windows, you know, Usabelli has talked to people about that all over, the health impact assessment will take into consideration, you know, the fact that people might be in their home and their windows would shatter.
Yes, and you know, I'm taking notes here because these are concerns. These are the kinds of concerns that I'm going to hear many of. We're going to write them down and basically answer them and try to get answers for them and make assessments on them as we go through the process.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, and I look forward to meeting you in person.
And Shauna, the link to the toolkit is now on our website if you need to, at alaskapublic.org. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you.
You bet. Well, that took a little bit longer than I anticipated, but I think it was good and useful information. Thanks for responding to her. We've only got a minute or so. I have a really important question in my mind is, do we have good evidence of the effectiveness of these programs? We need to constantly monitor that what we're doing is making some sense.
And we've mentioned here in Alaska, things are just getting rolling. But I think that's probably a fair assessment of HIA in the U.S. There are some, I really want to take a second to point out the Health Impact Project. This is a group in Washington, D.C., and they're doing probably most of the effectiveness studies of HIA in the U.S. And if anyone has put together some information, they would have. But as we talked earlier, in the international scene, the World Health Organization has done a lot of looking at HIA, and there is a document online. If people just Google HIA effectiveness, they will see a whole, I think it's 350-page document about a group of people who have taken the time to look at how these HIAs are reviewed, and so that's there for folks.
Good. Thanks very much. This is, again, it's new. I think Tom, who called earlier, said it very well. It's about time that we look at human health assessments. It makes sense to me. Obviously, there's always concerns about costs and other issues. I want to thank both of you for taking the time to be with us. Next week, we're going to be back August 1st, and we're going to be talking about cancer survivorship with Julia Thorstness of the State Division of Public Health. Pat Yack is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack worked very hard today to engineer today's program. We appreciate her help. Thanks for you who have listened, and especially to those of you who called and emailed. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.